This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is supported by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Hey. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in to WNRN and The Wake Up Call. Thanks to 91.9 and Richmond's 103.1 listeners. And as always, thanks to our guests. Today's guest, Jeff Skelly. Good morning, Jeff.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for being here again one more time because, you know, we got all this new equipment and I'm not always super fast at learning technological stuff. Lazarus is often faster than I am. So, Jeff, tell us a little bit about yourself from UVA's Center of Politics.
It's the University of Virginia Center for Politics, and I'm the media relations coordinator there, but I also serve as a political analyst. I assist Larry Sabato, who I think probably a lot of your listeners are aware of who that is. He's a professor at UVA, and he founded the Center for Politics back in the late 90s, and I help him kind of read the lay of the land in politics, whether it's rating races or discussing kind of the ongoing issues of the day in Washington and in Richmond.
Well, thanks so much for being here with us. Jeff Skelly giving up some of his Sunday morning after a little soccer match. We're going to open up the phones today. You're welcome to call us up and participate in today's program. 434-979-0919. Again, 434-979-0919 to talk with Jeff Skelly about, we'll do a little post-election politics. Jeff, one of the first things I want to talk about, explain the crystal ball, because that is something that, for which Larry Sabato and the UVA Center Politics is known for, the Crystal Ball.
The Crystal Ball is a weekly newsletter that we put out basically dissecting what's going on in American politics. We rate all the Senate and gubernatorial races, all the House races. Basically, we just kind of review the landscape, and we talk about basically every election we make projections of who's going to win, and we basically talk about that the whole year, but we also discuss presidential approval ratings, special election. I mean, we run the gamut of politics, and it comes out every Thursday morning. You can get it in your inbox. It's very easy. It's centerforpolitics.org/crystalball, and that's where the website is.
What's the rating for accuracy?
It's pretty high. Professor Sabato is renowned for his wisdom and clarity when talking about politics, and we like to think that we do the same thing with our ratings. We've generally speaking had 98-99% accuracy when it comes to calling all the states and the presidential elections, all the Senate races, all the gubernatorial elections. House races are a little harder, but we have a good rating on that too. My colleague Kyle Kondik is—he knows the House very, very well. The U.S. House of Representatives. When I say the House, and so that's—we have a pretty good track record.
So we had a recent race here in Virginia, the gubernatorial, and the others, both state and I guess the House races that took place. Mm-hmm. But the current news, and we'll get into the whole topic, the current news is that the attorney general race was so tight, down to, I believe, double-digit number of who's winning, Obenchain or Herring. There's expected, I guess, probably legally have a recount on that. And then the news that I saw today, the accusation, of course, from a one-sided report, I always consider this to be a one-sided report, is that those darn Republicans are changing the law on how to do a recount after the election has already taken place.
Yeah, my understanding is that currently the attorney general's race is at least on the website, the State Board of Elections website right now, Mark Obenshane, the Republican, has a 55-vote lead. But with a lot of votes that haven't been added in yet from provisional ballots that have been counted around the state, Mark Herring actually has a lead that I think has been estimated at about 80. And obviously that is unbelievably close when there are over 2 million votes cast in the entire state. Fairfax County, the largest locality in the state, over a million people, has about 500 provisional ballots that need to be counted, it has to be determined whether or not they count. And my understanding is that the state attorney general's office sent a memo to the Fairfax Board of Elections reminding them to enforce the way the law is written in the state now in terms of provisional ballots, which involves the voter is contacted, or they vote with a provisional ballot, and they are informed that they have, I think, 3 days, something like that, to send in either to show up in person with an ID saying they are who they are, or to send a fax or by mail proof of who they are. Because a lot of people voting for provisionally, it's either they showed up at the wrong precinct or they didn't have an ID with them, that kind of thing. My understanding is that the county of Fairfax typically allows legal representation for voters who aren't necessarily there the day that they're actually determining whether or not to count these ballots. But the way the law is written, apparently, that's not permitted. If there is a question, like a legal question, the voter has to be there for a legal representative to be able to like step in. And so my understanding is that the state is trying to make sure that there is uniform standards across the state for how they're counting these. But the way Fairfax County has been doing it for years doesn't jive with that. And so that has created some, I think, consternation. Because obviously, I think at the end of the day, everybody wants votes that should count to count. And so, you know, I don't think it's vote stealing on either side or something. Or I think it's just a disagreement.
But these votes, apparently, for this one county would... they go back to the other counties and possibly change any vote count there?
See, I'm not sure about that. I know that the Attorney General's office they want to make sure that the manner in which provisional ballots are cast is equal no matter whether you're in Lee County in Southwest Virginia or if you're in Fairfax in Northern Virginia. So if everyone else was following those rules as they're laid out, then I would assume there's probably going to be changes, but I can't be sure of that. I think this. I just learned about this about an hour ago, so it's kind of up in the air at the moment, I think.
But it sounds like a great topic for this upcoming Thursday's Crystal Ball.
Yes, we might address that. Yeah.
All right. Again, our guest today, Jeff Skelly from UVA's Center for Politics, where he helps put together the Crystal Ball, known I guess mostly for Larry Sabato, but he has helpers.
Yes.
Which Jeff Skelly is one. You don't get to be well-known and so talented at political projections without having people like Jeff Skelly help do the I don't want to say dirty work, but do the underwork. Is that even a word?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, me either. I like to invent words during the hour. That's what happens with a live microphone.
Shakespeare would be proud.
Jeff Skelly, Rick Moore here talking about politics after the election. So, Jeff, let's talk about the gubernatorial race. It seems that leading up to the election, many people seemed unhappy with the two candidates. And not just sort of you hear this regularly in the last decade or more about how, why couldn't they give us somebody better? You know, many politicians, you know, don't deserve their job, blah, blah, blah. But with this particular Virginia race, it seemed like people were extra unhappy with the candidates. How did we get to those two if people were so unhappy with the end result?
Well, the way it worked out is that on the Democratic side, there was essentially no one positioned to run except for Terry McAuliffe. He more or less cleared the field. I think if anyone had run against him, it was kind of the understanding that he was going to be able to raise a lot of money, and it was probably going to be difficult to beat him in a Democratic primary. And on the Republican side, Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli had the backing of, I think, the majority of the grassroots of the Republican Party in Virginia, and he ended up actually, his allies ended up taking control of the Republican Central Committee in the state. And originally there was going to be a Republican primary for governor, but his allies on the committee changed it to a convention setting, understanding that that was going to get basically all but assure Cuccinelli of the gubernatorial nomination. And that way he would avoid a perhaps lengthy and embattled primary against Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling. So Bowling, once they decided to go to convention, dropped out of the race. And of course, he flirted with a possible independent bid for a little bit, but decided against it, which I think he might be kicking himself right now for that. I could be wrong. But you are right that the favorability ratings of both these candidates in the days leading up to the election were well below 50. So it was... Virginians were not very happy with their choices.
What about you? You mentioned, and I read this on the again. How do people get linked into the Crystal Ball weekly report?
Oh, sure. You can go to our website, which is centerforpolitics.org/crystalball, one word. And once there, there's a little sign up thing on the right side of the screen. You can put your email in there, and you can get it in your inbox every Thursday morning at about 6 a.m. Or you can just go to the site every Thursday morning, and it's whichever you prefer.
In the Crystal Ball report that I read was that that changing from the primary method to the convention method of selecting the candidate really didn't cause this huge fiasco of, you know, Cuccinelli being the being the representative for the Republicans. Why do you say that?
We said that because at the end of the day, if there had been a primary, I still think Ken Cuccinelli would have won over Bill Bowling for the Republican nomination. I mean, to think otherwise is to kind of underestimate Cuccinelli's appeal to the Republican base and to exaggerate the amount of support that Bowling would get from more moderate Republicans and people who are either independents or Democrats who would cross over and vote in the Republican primary. And considering that there was a competitive Democratic primary in both the lieutenant governor and attorney general's races, you wouldn't have gotten Democrats voting in the Republican primary the same way you might have, say, back during the 2012 election, primary election for the Republican nomination for president. I mean, there was nothing on the Democratic side. So in Virginia, we have open primaries, so you don't have to be registered with that party to vote in that party's primary. So at the end of the day, Cuccinelli probably would have still likely won the Republican nomination through a primary. But you can't know that for sure because it never happened.
Jeff Skelly here from UVA Center for Politics as we talk about politics, amazingly enough. But do you think that method of determining your candidate will go back towards the primary method after, for many people, for many Republicans, didn't work?
I think that's actually tough to say because the Republican base, many of them are going to prefer a convention method because it's going to give them, they believe, a more ideologically pure candidate. No rhinos or no Republicans in name only. And whereas I think there is credible evidence that a primary at least creates the opportunity for more electable candidates to get nominated. Are they necessarily going to be ideologically 100% what you want, either if you're a Democrat or a Republican? Probably not, but it's like actual proof that they can win votes and do well in an election. And it's evidence that perhaps they can then take that to the general and actually have a chance of winning.
But you also end up with candidates such as Mr. Jackson, who was running to be lieutenant governor, who had received the lowest number of votes, got beat by the greatest percentage, and for many people, Republicans felt that he was the least likely to be elected even before the election took place because of his hardcore beliefs.
Well, absolutely. That is the fly in the ointment with the convention method. And actually, as it worked out, the Republicans decided to use a convention to choose their nominee to guarantee Ken Cuccinelli the nomination for governor. But that created a situation where there was a lot of uncertainty in the lieutenant governor's race because there were seven Republican candidates running for the office. So at a convention setting, it's mainly about how many of your supporters can you get to show up at the convention? It's not a statewide election where people choose to go to the polls and cast a ballot. So it created a lot more uncertainty. And in the end, E.W. Jackson ended up winning the nomination, which is a credit to him because he apparently understood the convention rules very well and got his people there and did a very good job.
Right. He played the best under the rules that were there.
Yes, exactly. But from a statewide perspective, E.W. Jackson had run in a 2012 U.S. Senate primary and gotten roughly 5% of the vote, which would seem to signal that he was not exactly the strongest candidate. And pretty much from the day he was nominated, there was a feeling that no matter what happened elsewhere, unless Ken Cuccinelli won by a very large margin, E.W. Jackson was not going to be able to win. So I think from the get-go, that race was considering that I don't think anyone thought that Cuccinelli or McAuliffe was going to run away with the race, there was a feeling that Ralph Northam is almost certainly going to be lieutenant governor no matter what happens.
Talking with Jeff Skelly here on the Wake Up Call. Jeff's from UVA Center for Politics. We'll open up the phone lines if somebody wants to call in. The newly wired, all kinds of special equipment set up phone lines. We'd love to hear your voice over our new equipment. 434-979-0919. That's right, 434-979-0919.
Today's programming on WNRN is supported by
The Southern Cafe and Music Hall, 103 South First Street in Charlottesville. The Southern presents Houndmouth Tuesday, Lee Baines III and the Glory Fires Wednesday, Black Uhuru Thursday, The Last Bison Friday, and Baja Boulé and Ben Soli Saturday. For more event listings or tickets, thesouthernseaville.com.
Millwork for Less, the exclusive supplier of wood entry doors for Craig Builders. Millwork for Less builds doors for homeowners and builders all over North America. You can find their online store at millworkforless.com.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us today. Jeff Skelly here, UVA Center for Politics, as we talk about post-election politics. Jeff, you know, we've mentioned several times about the Crystal Ball Report. You can, if nothing else, Google it and sign up for its weekly, every Thursday, email blowout. Some of the things that I read on the site, and some of these are quoted and some are just slightly paraphrased, but the McAuliffe's mandate from the voters was pretty much just not to let Cuccinelli win.
Precisely. There's been a lot of talk that the public polling in this race, in the governor's race, showed McAuliffe up by roughly 6 points going into Election Day. And he only won by about 2.5. They're still figuring out the final vote counts, but it's going to be roughly 2.5 percentage points. It turns out the internal polling for the McAuliffe campaign actually had it closer, more like 4. But at the end of the day, it does seem like Cuccinelli was closer in the end than people expected him to be. And I think there's been some talk that this is somehow an impressive thing, considering, and there's, I think, been a lot of complaints from some Republicans that the National Party did not get behind Cuccinelli, and if they had, then maybe he could have made up that margin in the end. But generally speaking, our view of the election result is that Terry McAuliffe won because Ken Cuccinelli was just too conservative for a fairly middle-of-the-road state, as it is presently, and that the fact that Terry McAuliffe actually won at all is pretty remarkable, given the fact that he had no governing experience, never been held elected office, basically had just been a fundraiser.
Isn't really a Virginian to many people.
Exactly. There were questions about, was he really a Virginian? I think the Ken Cuccinelli campaign liked to run attacks about it. He was considering running for office in other states at some point earlier in his career. And basically, it had just been a Clinton insider. And I think a lot of people viewed his background as one that was going to have a difficult time winning a statewide race in Virginia. I mean, he got pretty well beaten in the 2009 Democratic gubernatorial primary. And so there wasn't really a strong track record there that would make you think, oh, Terry McAuliffe is definitely going to win this. Now, you knew he could raise money, but was he actually going to be appealing enough to Virginians? And he was appealing enough in the sense that he's not King Cuccinelli. That is basically how it worked out.
Just to follow up to the one of the earlier questions. So Terry McAuliffe's money scared enough potential Democratic candidates away that he was the one person to fight off Ken Cuccinelli. And so for many people, that's my only choice, but I guess I have to take it. So it all comes down to money and campaign financing in this race.
I wouldn't say it was just the money. The money advantage that McAuliffe had over Cuccinelli certainly helped him win in the end, because it allowed him to run, I think it was something like two-thirds. Pro-McAuliffe ads were like, there were two-thirds as many Cuccinelli pro-Cuccinelli ads as there were pro-McAuliffe ads in this race, and that just kind of reflects the fact that McAuliffe just had a lot more money, and that allows you to build a better campaign infrastructure. It allows you to do better voter contact, and it allows you to run a lot more TV ads. And so for all those reasons, that helped McAuliffe. But again, I think at the end of the day, there was a lot for McAuliffe to attack, and that was an important aspect to this. You can point to the money as being important, because it is, because at the end of the day, most of the time, the candidate raises more money wins, but that's not 100% like, oh, if you raise more money, you're going to win. Because if that were the case, there are a lot of politicians who would have been elected who have not been.
Now, there was an independent candidate, Mr. Sarvis, who early on was getting numbers that made it sound like he might get up to 10% of the votes. In the end, 6.5, is that correct?
Yes.
And so one of the, one of the points of feedback that I heard from that was that when you're called by phone and asked who you're going to vote for, and because you don't care for either candidate, you say, I'll go for Mr. Sarvis. But when it came time and you closed the curtain behind you in the voting booth, you were so scared that the other person might win that the Republicans and Democrats came home to vote.
Exactly. Polling had shown, actually, that Democrats were pretty much firmly behind Terry McAuliffe. But some polling had indicated that there was enough of a split in Republican ranks, a fair number of moderate Republicans being a little bit uncertain about backing Cuccinelli and even potentially saying they would back McAuliffe, that there was a lot of talk about a division in the Republican Party. But exit polling indicated that, for the most part, Republicans came home to Cuccinelli on Election Day. And probably the main reason that McAuliffe won, if you know exit polling is to be believed, is that the electorate that showed up was more Democratic than Republican. And that ended up giving him the win, whereas in 2009, it was a very Republican electorate, and Bob McDonald, you know, won in a landslide.
Why is that the case? Because that surprised me when I read the numbers, is that I think that something that I read, whether it was from Crystal Ball Report or not, self-identified Democrats were 5% more of the electorate. Because what many people say is that the people who go to vote in these off-year elections are the diehards, and that it's seemingly to me that the Tea Party voters, whether it's a stereotype or not, would be more diehard than your standard off-the-street Democrat.
I think it's difficult to measure diehardness, if you will, for making up words this morning. But I think that there are a relatively equal number of diehards on both sides. And when you think about the 2012 presidential election, the electorate in Virginia, there's some just basic fundamentals to all this. That's what I'm going to talk about here. 70% of the electorate in the 2012 election was white in Virginia. And white voters supported Obama nationally, I think it was like 39%. And it was lower in Virginia. I think it was 37, if I recall correctly. And the electorate in the 2009 gubernatorial race was over 75% white. And so when you're talking about non-white voters giving Democrats over 80% of their support, almost every percentage uptick in the non-white vote is almost a full percentage point for the Democratic candidate. So when the electorate in 2013 was relatively close to the electorate in 2012, that is how McAuliffe was able to win. Because if the electorate had looked like the last gubernatorial election when there was – I mean, Cuccinelli would be governor-elect. And so that – those are kind of – I think you have to look at the white vote and the non-white vote, because at the moment that's an important factor in this country. Obviously, the country is getting more diverse, and at present the way the – The way that white voters and non-white voters vote is very different. So as the non-white vote increases, which is almost certainly going to continue, you're going to have to probably see – Republicans are going to have to start winning larger blocks of the non-white vote if they're going to be competitive in statewide elections in states like Virginia, which are very close to the national kind of sense. Virginia in the last two presidential elections had the vote that was closest to the actual national outcome. And – if you nominate very conservative candidates who can't make any inroads with non-white voters, it makes it harder to win.
11:30 here on the Wake Up Call with guest Jeff Skelly from UVA's Center for Politics. Works on Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. If you have a question for Jeff, call us up. Love to test out this new phone equipment. 434-979-0919. That's 434-979-0919 here on WNRN's Wake Up Call. Jeff, talking about the percentage of voters going out to do their thing on Election Day and diehards, I read something where the Republican Party actually wanted a lower turnout because they thought that would help them win.
Well, there does seem to be evidence that the higher the turnout is in a race, the more Democratic leaning it is. And that probably is a reflection of what I was talking about earlier with non-white and white voters, is that wealthier white voters are basically the most certain people to show up in an election. I mean, wealthy voters in general, regardless of race or ethnicity. But at the margins, the people who may or may not show up in an election, that group is just more Democratic. But they're just not as engaged typically. And so the more of them who actually show up, creating a higher turnout, I mean, if they're Democratic leaning, that obviously is going to help the Democratic candidate. So Republicans, just the way the electorate is right now, in a lower turnout race, it's just more favorable to them.
Is that in any way, I don't know. I understand it. And I get the point of the different socioeconomic status groups mm-hmm. that fit into each category, at least on a broad stereotype. But is that – I don't know. It just makes me cringe just a little bit to think we want – you know, that I may want fewer people to vote so my candidate can win.
It does seem anti-democratic in the small d way. It seems, I think at the end of the day, in an ideal world, we would want everyone to show up and vote, and we would want them to take full consideration of all the issues and make their voice heard, make their vote count, and not kind of hope that the other side doesn't show up kind of thinking. But at present, we live in a very polarized society politically. The country is very divided on some very key issues, and there's not really a middle ground in sight, and both parties are kind of moving away from each other. Recent studies have shown that Congress is most polarized it's ever been in the entire history of the United States. You know, Republicans are – the average ideological score of the average Republican in the House of Representatives is further away from the average ideological score of the average Democrat in the House than has ever been. And that number, it's not getting closer together. There's no evidence that we're suddenly going to come back together. And so that's kind of where we're at.
And I'd like to think that I would be just as bothered by that if the Democratic side, someone representing the Democratic Party, said something similar in terms of, oh, we want fewer people to vote because I need my guy to win. It feels like, I don't know.
It makes you feel icky.
Yeah,
it does.
It makes me feel icky.
Yeah.
The picture I had in my head, for those who think that I am often weird and nuts, was moldy bread when that popped up is, I don't want anything to do with that. Let's throw that away. And unlike what somebody might say, I realize that moldy bread has its health benefits, but, you know, still, I don't like that. Jeff Skelly here, UVA Center for Politics. We talk about post-election politics. Let's go to a broader scale. You know, part of the conversation over the past week has all been about the Virginia governor's race and the New Jersey governor's race. And the New Jersey race tells us everything we need to know about the type of candidate that the Republicans need on a national level, because he won versus the Ken Cuccinelli hardcore right side who lost.
You know, what's interesting is that Chris Christie is not that moderate, like his actual record. He's a relatively conservative record. He got his start as governor. He kind of made waves when he really went hard after teachers unions. And that made him, your average Republican was very pleased about that. So he has a pretty conservative record, but he also has a very dynamic personality, and he doesn't focus on – basically, he tries to make his appeal as broad as possible. And you can be – basically, he's evidence that you can be conservative but win by having a broad appeal based on a dynamic personality and – an ability to convey your message to the voters, and without turning off large segments of the voter population. You know, the more people you get to actually listen to you, probably the better chance you have of at least them considering voting for you. And he did very well among minority groups, which is not something that Republicans have done a lot lately. And so I think his win is probably some proof that he's got a good shot in 2016 if he ends up being the Republican nominee.
But we go back to the crystal ball output. Is that a week ago or maybe 2 weeks ago, one of your colleagues did a piece on Ted Cruz. And, you know, here we are. It's the easy stereotype, but it's the one that everyone seems to be talking about at the moment, is Chris Christie and his moderate view, mostly because I think of, as you said, his personality more so than his voting record. And Ted Cruz, who seems to be, I don't think you can say polar opposite, but certainly an opposite within his own Republican Party.
Absolutely. My colleague Kyle Kondik wrote a great piece about Ted Cruz and the trouble he may have with Republican elites, and how there is a track record of the candidate who gets the most backing from, say, if you're like Republican running for the presidential nomination, the more endorsements you get from other members of like the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate or governors, the person who gets the most of those is typically the nominee. And so Cruz has definitely made waves by, if you want to say, spitting in the face of the establishment. And voters love him for him. A lot of Texans just adore him. He's got a great approval rating in his home state, which at the end of the day, if you're a politician, the people voting for you are the ones you want to have loving you. So he's doing something right with that. But kind of on a national scale, if he does want to run for president, he isn't quite developing the relationships that he may need to help boost him. At the end of the day, though, that's not necessarily going to prevent him from having a shot at the nomination. In the past, there's been moments where the establishment didn't get their choice. 1964, Barry Goldwater. 1972, George McGovern for the Democrats. So sometimes the base, sometimes the kind of activist part of the party on either side gets what they want. But the election track record for those individuals is not particularly strong, which perhaps should caution people when they are thinking about who to choose. But when you talk about the 2016, on the Republican side, at least the 2016 race, there's just a very large number of potential candidates. I mean, there's Cruz and there's Christie, but there's also Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, comes to mind. I think John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, might be interested himself. So there's a lot of potential candidates out there. It's going to be very interesting to see how it shakes up. The Democratic side is more or less, will Hillary run? That's really the only question on that side at the moment.
Will she?
No idea.
The crystal ball doesn't have a poll going or anything like that.
No, we don't poll. It's expensive. We use other people's polls, which is a lot cheaper. I mean, I would say at the moment that I think Hillary probably will run. I think the appeal of perhaps being the first female president is just too much for her to pass up. But at the end of the day, we're still a couple years away from knowing that. And she may decide against it. You never know. She's not young. Some health problem might arise. You just can't know what is going to happen. But if I had to bet, I would bet more on her running. If it was an over-under here, I would take the over because I think she probably will run.
Our guest today, Jeff Skelly from UVA's Center for Politics.
WNRN thanks the following for their support of independent music radio.
Commonwealth Restaurant and Sky Bar, 422 East Main Street on Charlottesville's downtown mall. Serving dinner and drinks in the bar or at the Sky Bar overlooking the mall. Commonwealth is available for private parties and serves brunch on Sundays. For more information, it's commonwealthskybar.com.
Atlantic Organic Natural Sleep Shop, featuring their natural and chemical-free organic sleep studio with environmentally conscious mattresses and bedding, including eco-friendly hardwood platform beds. That's Atlantic Organic, 421 West Main Street, Charlottesville. Website AtlanticOrganicSleepShop.com. It's bedtime naturally.
Hi, I'm Jesse Harper, inviting you to a celebratory night of music. On December 22nd, an all-star group of musicians will collaboratively perform visual and performance art with children of all abilities in Live Art, Tree of Life. This event will feature Jason Mraz, Katie Lang, Christina Perry, Renee Marie, Susan Greenbaum, myself, and many others. Live Art is more than just a concert event. For the past year, 120 students with a range of developmental disabilities, hearing and vision impairment, participate in performing arts classes alongside typically developing students. Each class will collectively perform their visual and performance art with the featured musicians in the Live Art Tree of Life concert at the Landmark Theater. For more information about our programs and tickets for the show, visit us at sparkonline.org. I'm Jesse Harper, making a community connection on WNRN.
Make your community connection with WNRN. Email connection at WNRN.org with your nonprofit event or organization's information. Independent Music Radio, WNRN.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you so much for being with us. I love having you people here. And today is WNRN and the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call talking about politics. Jeff Skelly's here, University Center for Politics. He assists with the famous crystal ball that Larry Sabato puts out. Jeff, will Virginia ever allow consecutive terms for governor? Are you aware of any conversation where that takes place as a yes soon?
I think it's unlikely to happen in the near future. There's been basically every single General Assembly session, somebody from one party or the other puts forward an amendment asking for this to happen, for two consecutive terms to be an option. It probably doesn't usually make it out of committee, much less get voted on by the full House of Delegates or the full state Senate. So it's difficult to see it happen anytime soon, and I'm not really sure what the circumstances would be that would bring it about. Some people might argue that it might be a blessing, given the most recent gubernatorial campaign, that one of those individuals was only going to be governor for 4 years, no matter which one won. And I know plenty of people, including my boss, who's a fan of the one term limit. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other. I could see pros and cons on both sides, but I don't see it happening anytime soon, and I'm not really sure what would spark an actual movement for that change to happen.
Well, and I guess part of the follow-up to that is, even for a four-year term, for Terry McAuliffe, who won this time around, the same or a similar polarization that's happening on the national level is happening here, or is expected to happen with a Democratic governor here in the state of Virginia, correct?
Well, I think just generally, if you look at our politics, and all, this is true all over the country, the polarization that we see at the federal level is certainly trickling down into state-level politics and even local-level politics, which I think many people would argue is probably not a good thing. The Washingtonization of Richmond, for instance, more difficult to find compromise, to find common ground. But to a certain degree, all this talk misses the point that we, the voters, are responsible as much as anything for all this. And because the voters are the ones who show up and they're the ones who appeals to kind of the left and to the right. They're the ones who are influenced by it, who are influenced by it to go and vote for their respective side. And really, voters are as polarized as their politicians are. And I think I think the average person is not inclined to be really hard one way or the other, but the way they vote would indicate that they are kind of. And if you actually ask them to write down, like, what did they think about, you know, issue A, B, C, they're usually going to fall pretty hard one way or the other on a lot of those. And so at the end of the day, the polarization of our politics is also a product of just voters being more polarized.
I bring this up out of the blue to you. There was an article that I read about the I think it's the Modern Whig Party. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not, though I do feel like I heard something about this.
There was somebody in Pennsylvania who actually ran as a modern Whig who won.
Sounds like the
local,
first Whig to win in like 150 years,
right,
or something.
Right, who ran as a, you know, for a local space where the vote part, the votes was like 25 to 36 or something. So it wasn't in any way a big case. But just the standard reading without any in-depth research into it talked about how the Whig Party is known for its conservative financials and its liberal socialization of things. And I thought, you know, I wonder how that would play out if the modern Whig Party were to actually make a real comeback in any way.
It would certainly be interesting. The problem for any third party in the United States is that the system under which we operate favors a two-party system. It's the way we vote. It's called first past the post. Essentially, whoever gets the largest number of votes wins. They don't have there's and they win. Winner, it's winner take all, essentially. If you're voting for your local House of Delegates seat, even if you have an independent candidate there who gets like 10%, well, the winner might end up with like 44%, but they still win. They may not have gotten a majority. They don't need to get a majority to win. And it's not proportional representation like in many countries around the world, particularly Europe, where, oh, well, this party got 40% of the votes, so they get 40% of the seats or something, you know, of that nature. And so that favors – that system favors a two-party system because it's – and we see this in the UK because they use a similar system. Now, they do have a third party that is the Liberal Democrats that have hung around and have made strides that are part of the current governing coalition in the UK. But at the end of the day, the two major parties are still Labour and Conservative in the UK, and they use the same voting system we use. And that system just in general favors two parties because voters go to the polls and they know whoever gets the most votes wins. And so they're going to try to vote for one of the, you know, who they think is going to win. Or they're more inclined to vote for the major two parties because they actually have a shot at winning.
Right, and that's what we talked about earlier
with Sarvis.
With Sarvis,
yeah.
People by phone poll saying that they might vote for him, but actually in the booth might not have voted for him because they didn't want to, quote, waste their vote.
Strategic voting, exactly.
I'd like to look more into it. Maybe you can do an article on the modern Whig Party. I'm curious to see how that whether that would make. I think if you win 36-25, you're not really having a huge impact on the state or the national issue. But I still think it would be interesting.
I feel like I need to start making a Henry Clay joke or something here.
and that would go over my head, and I did some preparation.
The American system or something, yeah.
you know, one of the things, coattails, people always talk about coattails. Mm-hmm. And here in Albemarle County, two gentlemen who were running for reelection didn't win. Two Republicans running for reelection on the Board of Supervisors didn't win. And typically, if you are an incumbent, it's much easier to win back your seat. But that didn't happen this time around. Is that all part of the coattails? McAuliffe wins. We have two Democrats as our senators. And so even in Albemarle, which is a little more, if, you know, either way, the Democrats win.
I mean, I think at the end of the day, the coattails probably had a lot to do with it. There was obviously this local thing with the bypass that I think a lot of people would point to. But at the end of the day, Terry McAuliffe won Albemarle pretty handily, and that enabled other Democrats down the ticket to benefit. And the same the two gentlemen you're speaking of on the Board of Supervisors, the Republicans who were defeated, they got in the same way in 2009 when Bob McDonald won a crushing victory in the state and won Albemarle County, and that helped them get into office in the first place. And that's because there aren't a lot of people splitting tickets these days. If you vote for a Democrat at the top of the ticket, there's a very good chance you're going to vote for the Democrat in every single office that you choose to vote in. And if you vote for a Republican at the top of the ticket, there's a very good chance you're going to vote for the Republican the whole way down. We were talking about E.W. Jackson earlier, and everybody expected him to lose, and he did, by about 10 points. But he still got about 45% of the vote. And that just kind of points, I think, because I think there's in the past, there would have been a chance that E.W. Jackson might have gotten only like 30% of the vote. But at the end of the day, there were a lot of Republicans who voted for him anyway because he was the Republican.
Right. He got over a million votes, correct?
Yeah.
Again, our guest, Jeff Skelly from UVA's Center for Politics. As surprisingly, we talk about politics. What's it made Jeff a great guest. Go back to how Cuccinelli got the nominee, because the current governor, Mr. McDonald, early on said that he would represent Bill Bowen or offer up Bill Bowen to be the next nominee. And that didn't happen. Or I guess maybe it happened. He did say, let's vote for Bill Bowen, but it didn't work out the way it was planned because Mr. Bowen was battling to be the nominee in 2009. And sort of stepped aside when Mr. McDonald said, let me do it this time and I'll support you in 4 years.
Yeah, there was definitely a deal made between McDonald and Bowling where McDonald said, look, if I run this time, you will for sure get my support in 2013. And King Cuccinelli didn't get the memo, apparently. It's probably good to make sure that all three of the if you're going to sweep the three statewide offices, it's probably good to make sure that you have everyone on board with your plan. and you know, that's politics, timing, luck. There's a lot of things that go into this. And King Cuccinelli was in a better position within the Republican Party to become the party's nominee, and Bill Bowling was the one who suffered for it.
Why have we had so many Republican attorney generals over the year? We've had, you know, we seem to have gone both ways, Democrat, Republican in the governor's role. But for, and I'm sure you know this more exactly, for 30 plus years, it has always been a Republican attorney general. Why?
Well, it's been 24. 1989 was the last time that a Democrat won the Attorney General's office. So since the 1993 election, so 20 years, there's been only Republican Attorneys General. And I think that gets down to a couple things. One, for whatever reason, the Republicans have a stronger, I think a stronger, have had in the past at least, a stronger hold on the electorate in terms of law enforcement issues. And for whatever reason. And that has given them an advantage. Now that voting is a little bit more polarized, it is more polarized, I think you're going to see, for the most part, similar percentages from candidates from both sides in every election. And we're just going to have to see how it works out this time. The streak could be broken, or it could be another 4 years of having a Republican Attorney General. But I think it's also kind of the quality of the candidates, because if you look back in the Attorney General's races, most of the time the Republican nominee has been a better candidate at the end of the day, whether it's their profile or they just raised a heck of a lot more money than the Democrats. So I think there are multiple factors at play here.
Jeff Skelly with us here on WNRN. I want to take a moment and remind everybody that you can still make a pledge here at WNRN. You can become a member or renew your membership at any time by visiting WNRN.org. We suggest becoming an Evergreen member and make your support of independent music radio easy and ongoing. We still have new WNRN t-shirts, baseball hats, and membership cards, and the copies of that CD in studio at WNRN Volume 1 as a thank you for your premium gift to WNRN. Please go online, WNRN.org, become a member of our community, and a special thanks to everyone who's already donated or renewed your membership during the recent fund drive. All right, back to Jeff. Just a few minutes left. 11:54 here on the Wake Up Call. Jeff, I found this, and again, it's not an exact quote, but only minor paraphrasing. It says that while Obama is in the White House, Democrats are cooked in Southwest Virginia, because the percentage was over 55%, and some of the counties in the Southwest part of the state were over 75% voting for Ken Cuccinelli.
Yes.
Why does it matter that while Obama is in the White House?
For probably a few reasons. The president's appeal in Appalachia is very low. And I think probably a really obvious one is the battle is over the future of coal and the coal industry. And because the federal government presently, the EPA has obviously handed down some new regulations, and Republicans have very successfully cast Democrats the president and his administration as being basically against people in those regions. And they have reacted very negatively to the Democratic label in general.
You don't vote for the person who's going to take your job away.
Exactly. And so fears over that, and fears just kind of – and I also think there's probably cultural issues at play there. Voters – and I mean, Appalachian generally is pretty socially conservative, and – you know, the president's pretty liberal socially. And so with that in mind, it's kind of pushed socially conservative voters who were kind of economically moderate and had regularly voted for Democrats in many cases. I mean, Michael Dukakis won West Virginia. Think about that for a moment.
Is that the only state he won?
No,
I guess he also won Massachusetts.
He only won about five or six, but one of them was West Virginia. And Barack Obama didn't win a single county in West Virginia in 2012. And so there's been a shift there, and people in Appalachia have generally have found themselves identifying with the Republican Party more than the Democratic Party.
All right, again, Jeff Skelly with us for just a few more minutes. Jeff, we were talking about this race here in Virginia, the race up in New Jersey. do you, does the crystal ball think that there have, that these races will play the same significance that other media seem to do so? Because there was also a race for a Republican candidacy down in Alabama, where it was sort of a standard Republican versus a Tea Party-ish Republican, and the standard Republican won. So are these races truly, you know, sort of the backlash that people seem to think, or is it just because of what happened in October?
I think it's difficult to say with any certainty that this is some kind of backlash. I don't think that conservative Republicans are going anywhere in the sense that they're going to continue to support individuals that they believe embody what they think and believe. So in Alabama, actually, the fact that the Tea Party candidate actually got pretty close to winning, even though he was vastly outspent and outgunned by establishment forces, would suggest that they're not going anywhere. And so there's been a lot of talk in the media about it, and there's even been talk about how the race in Virginia somehow is indicative of 2014, the upcoming congressional midterms. And I think that that's a dangerous thing to say, because especially with the Virginia race, given the two candidates we had, I don't think you can really take any kind of long view out of it. It was two flawed candidates, and the one who was kind of closer ideologically to the way Virginia is at the moment is the one who ended up winning.
Are we still, or will we remain, what's being called a swing state? I mean, I don't think that was necessarily the case 12 years ago, but it seems to have been the case the last three presidential elections.
At the moment, Virginia, I think, is probably the best indicator of any state in the country, which of course makes it very interesting to be here and talk about politics in this state at the moment, is because it really is an embodiment of the country as a whole. You have rural areas, you have a lot of suburban areas, and you have a lot of urban areas. And for whatever reason, Virginia at the moment reflects kind of where the country is at the moment. And will it continue to do that in the long run? I don't know. Ohio has long been one of the best indicators of where the country is at politically. It's for a long time been the swing state. You know, perhaps Virginia can overtake that, but we'll just have to see. Stuff to say.
All right, Jeff, thanks so much for being with us today. I always like talking about politics after the election, not just talking about the polls going up to the politics.
It's a lot easier afterwards, actually.
Yeah, once we already know the answers. Jeff Skelly, UVA Center for Politics. Again, you can go online if you're interested and get the crystal ball report kicked out to you every Thursday. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, next week we'll be talking with Barbara Norden and Hawes Spencer about missing persons, some of the history, some of the more historical missing persons in our area. And I think that'll be quite interesting. Thanks, everybody. Les Thimps Perdue up next.
This has been your Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on WNRN. The Wake Up Call is supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Brandon Wong. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.